What a privilege it's been to be with you this weekend. I want to thank everybody that had anything to do with putting this convention together, but especially the folks that have attended. How many folks, this is their first time here this weekend? Can I see your hand? Okay. So, to make it so that you just don't hate me up front, let me qualify. Christmas, 1976. I make arrangements with my folks. I'm living in Seattle at the time, in the Pike Place Market. And it's a great place because you can drink at 4 o'clock in the morning there. It's a very nice place because that's where the people who peddle fish and who peddle fruit are there. And I'm living down in that neighborhood. And so I make arrangements that my folks are going to come by and pick me up. And my mother, my stepfather, my great-grandfather, and my 8-year-old sister. And they're going to come by and get me at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're going to go to church, and then we're going to go out and do some family stuff. And fortunately for me, you know how in AA we have home groups? You know, because we show up there no matter what? And that's because most of us had home bars. We had bars where we showed up no matter what. And my home bar was the Mint Lounge, which was about from here to the kitchen away from where I lived. Very convenient. And fortunately, on Christmas Day, they opened at 6 a.m. Very thoughtful, very spiritual. And so I decide that I should go over and have a few pops just to kind of get right for the day, because I'm a morning drinker. From the time I was I started drinking in the morning in seventh grade. So I was about 13 years old. I just didn't drink like a normal seventh grader. So anyway, so morning drinking is very familiar. I mean, why wait, right? My wife is still upset at that kind of attitude that I have about her. You know, I wake up with the trophy wife, and it's, why wait? So anyway, I go over to my home bar, and a miracle had happened. The state of Washington, which was the sole importer of alcohol, had decided to let mezcal be imported into the state of Washington. Now, mezcal is a liquor that's made from cactus, and in order to find out whether or not it has fermented properly, they drop a worm into the bottle, and if the worm dies, you can sell it. With certain types of people, moi, the goal of drinking mezcal is to eat the worm. This is supposedly something very male and virile. Most women just think it's very stupid. So I see this bottle of mezcal, and it becomes my mission to eat the worm. Now, it has to be able to come out of the bottle, right? So you can't really, you know, go down and find it. So you just got to get to drinking. And by the time 9 o'clock came around, I was only about a third of the way through the bottle, and I'm trying to urge other people who hadn't had the privilege of drinking mezcal before to the beauty of drinking a liquor with dead bugs in it. Oh yeah, yeah, this is really great. Try it, you know. Get away, dude. So my parents come, and they park, and they ring the doorbell, and I'm able to look through. Actually, I was on the second floor, and the entryway to my apartment building was just across the way, and I saw him be concerned and walk around and, you know, wait about 10 minutes, and then they finally left so I could do what it is that I needed to do, which is to try and drink the worm. And then about 45 minutes later, they came back. And I had to watch them again, be concerned and all that, and go off into their Christmas. They did not come back after that, wondering what had happened to me again. That's the kind of social drinker I am. That's what alcohol means to me. And that was 3 years before I came to you. I've been sober consecutively since the second day of May in 1979. So I hope that convinces you that just maybe I qualify as to being here. I cannot think of a more wonderful day to be able to speak at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting than on Mother's Day. 79 years ago today, a proctologist, who's a doctor that operates on people's rear ends. Many people don't know that that's what Dr. Bob was. He was a proctologist that shook a lot. Not real good for the practice. And the night before, he'd come home and had passed out, and his wife had gotten a call from a woman, Henrietta Seiberling. And Henrietta had been praying for Bob to find an answer. They had met each other in the Oxford group in Akron, Ohio. And there was a practice that people had called getting guidance, meditative practice. If you want to know what the practice is, all you have to really do is look on page 86 and 87 and 88 of the Big Book. But this idea of getting guidance, and she'd received guidance that God was going to send someone that was going to help her friend, and this guy who was an Oxford Group member from New York had called up and said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I need to find another drunk." And Henrietta was flabbergasted, you know. I mean, she was overjoyed, and she called. She said to Bill, "Come over here right now," because she wanted to make sure that he knew what he was talking about. Bill said it was the most interesting talk he'd ever had with somebody, because he'd always tried to tell people that he wasn't a drunk. And here's this woman who doesn't really understand, and he's trying to convince her to that he's a drunk. And so he tells her a little bit. She says, "Great." Goes over, calls her friend, Anne. She was Anne's sponsor in the Oxford group. Calls her up, and she says, "He's here. Get Bob. Get over here." And Ann says, "He's passed out. There's nothing we can do. Maybe we can make the call tomorrow." And so the next morning, Bob is horribly hungover. He had to take lots of barbiturates every day just to make it to be able to drink at night. So if you ever hear about drugs and alcoholism and like there's a problem between the two, just take a look at the co-founder, Bob Smith, daily eating barbiturates. And so anyway, they're driving over to the house, and Bob's son, who they called Smitty's, driving the car, and Bob says to him, Dr. Bob, saintly Dr. Bob says, young man, if you value your life and if you ever want to drive this car again, we're going to give these people 15 minutes. And then if I'm not out the door, I want you to come up and knock on the door and say that there's been a train wreck. They need every surgeon in town to come and help and get me the hell out of there. And Bob walks in the door, and Bill looks at him and says, boy, you really look like you need a drink. And they went back into a little library. And I mean, you can actually go into this room. And they sat there and they talked for almost 6 hours. That was on Mother's Day of 1939. So here we meet on the 79th anniversary of the day that these two men got together. Now, the founding day of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that day. So this is a fascinating thing to me, and it should be to you too. But I find this very interesting. Our movement, you know, what's
the day that it started?
Well, it's not the day that Bill Wilson has the white light experience. If we were a religion, that would be, you know, oh, Bill has this incredible sudden experience. And I'll talk about the nature of spiritual experience in a little while. But he has this white light experience, and his drink problem was removed. That was something that had happened off and on, you know, over history. And he starts working with other drunks, and nobody stays sober. And then he finally meets Bob. And he and Bob get together, and Bob, after this conversation that I'm talking about that happened on Mother's Day, stops drinking abruptly. And if you ever wanted to find out just how bad a drunk and a dope fiend Bob was, read Dr. Bob's Nightmare in the book. I mean, the guy actually says, I won't tell you of the dozens of times I ended up in the sanitarium. Dozens. And so he stops drinking, and he and Bill are working together. Bill is thrilled. This is the first guy that he has ever spoken with that had stopped drinking abruptly. And Bob's wife is thrilled. They move Bill into the house just so he can help Bob through. And a couple weeks later, Bob says, well, I need to go to Atlantic City to go to the AMA convention because this is something I always do. Anne is absolutely horrified. She knows what happens when Bob goes to the convention. He always gets absolutely plowed. She never knows what kind of guy is going to come back to him. He can't go. Bill says, look, either God's going to take care of this guy or he's not. Let him go. When Bob gets on the train, he starts drinking. He goes on a toot for 4 days, comes back. He's afraid to go home. So he calls his nurse, who comes and gets him off the platform, takes him home for a little while, settles him down. Bill is convinced that, you know, Bob's on a run. That's it. I'm going to pack my bags. I'm going back to New York. And Bob's wife says to him, won't you please give him another break? Will you just try one more time? We never had him stop drinking for a couple weeks before. Please just give him one more chance. Bill says, yeah. Okay, we'll give him another chance. Now, the thing is that this is like on Friday. Bob has started a procedure on a guy, and it has to be completed on Monday. So they've got to get Bob down enough that he can actually perform the operation, but they can't get him too far down that he can't handle the scalpel, right? So they're trying to give him just enough alcohol substituted with sauerkraut, vinegar, and tomato juice. And they're working on him, you know, getting him settled down. And the night before the operation on Sunday night, Dr. Bob says to Bill, I'm going to go through with this thing. And Bill thinks that he's talking about the operation. And he says, of course, Sheriff. And Bob says, no, I'm talking about that I'm actually going to go through these steps. Now, at the time, the Oxford group, they had four steps. And the third step was restitution. And Bob was unwilling to do that because he was afraid he'd lose his medical practice. And so he was avoiding it. He said, that's why I got drunk when I went to Atlantic City. He said, but I'm willing to go through with it. I will do absolutely anything for victory over alcohol. Okay. And he says, I'm going to get a thorough house cleaning, and you're going to hear it. And so he gave Bill his fifth step. Now, this is while he's getting settled out. And Bill said to him, you can't shock me. Go ahead and give it. And so they talked through the night because Bob wasn't sleeping much in those days. He was just sweating and shaking. And the next morning they went to the hospital for Bob to do the operation. On the way, Bill had decided that maybe he'd brought the doctor down a little bit too far. And so he gave him a bottle of beer and a goofball, a barbiturate, to go into the hospital to do the operation. There are many people who say the person who gave the most for Alcoholics Anonymous was the guy who got operated on that day. So Bob goes in, does the procedure. Bill goes back to the house on Ardmore, and Bob doesn't come home. For hours. And Bill says, well, you know, he and Annie both think, what are you going to think? He's out on a run. He got through this one. We got him out. That's it. So Bill starts packing. He'll catch the train. He'll go back to New York, back to his wife. It was a good start. And about 9 o'clock that night, Bob shows up. Can you imagine the untreated Al-Anons coming at him? Where have you been? And Bob says, I've been out mending fences. And we say that that's the 10th of June of that year. And of 1939. And that's the day that we call the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. The day that Dr. Bob went out and made amends. And it is in the making amends that this movement is very, very different than any other spiritual movement. Now, everybody says you should go out and do that stuff. Go out and clean the wreckage of your past. But here in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do is we have people that will show you how, that will talk you through it, that will say, when they say, I haven't spoken to my mother in 15 years. How do I do that? And her sponsor will say, well, maybe I don't know that, but I have a friend who had that experience. Why don't you speak to her? And it's our experience, strength, and hope that we share. And so I think that it's very, very vital that we acknowledge the fact that it was the starting of the program comes in the restitution. And that this is the thing that's, I won't say it's the most important step because the first step's really important. But the restitution is where the world changes. And one of the things that's fascinating is that many people think, well, I'm going out to make amends because I need to save my own life. I'm doing this for my sobriety. That's not why we do it at all. We do it because in that we liberate people from the shackles that we place them in. When I was a year and a half sober, I was tending bar at this place, and it was a really good job, and I only had two shifts a week, and I was just making enough money occasionally to meet my obligations. And instead of going to the owner and saying, I'll do anything here for you, you know, let me wash the walls, let me clean the parking lot, I need to make another $50 a week, I started stealing from the till. And I did that for a few weeks. And then I got another job, but that was in my mind, this spiritual crime that I had committed. And I went back to the man a while later, probably 4 or 5 months later, and I had $300 of the, like, $900 that I owed him. And I said, I need to talk to you. I said, I'm a thief, and I can't live with myself. I didn't say, oh, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I stated the nature of the spiritual crime. I'm a thief, and I can't live with myself, and here's part of the money that I owe you. And he looked at me, and he said, I have been in this business for 40 years. I have fired hundreds of people for stealing from me. And I have never, ever had anyone come and tell me that they couldn't tolerate themselves and that they would change and give me money. He said, nobody's ever even apologized for me except in begging to keep their job. He said, up until this moment, I have always believed that no one ever changes. I know now that people do. That man is, you know, so it had nothing to do with me. He never saw people the same way again. When I was a bartender, if you told me that you believed in God, I did my very best to intellectually battle with you, embarrass you, do whatever I could to dismiss what it was that you said you believed in. If you said you were monogamous, I did the same thing. I did that with hundreds of people. How do you make amends for that? every time a person stands before me and states whatever their spiritual conviction is, I support them. I celebrate it. Anytime anybody says that they're making any kind of a pledge to another person, I support it. That's how I make amends for those things. So this whole thing of making amends is the thing that really is the driving force of this movement. Two people get together in Akron in 1939. Now, just for fun, alcoholism and drug addiction in those days is a death sentence. It's a moral failing. So somebody tell me an incurable illness. Just give me one.
HIV.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you. Okay. HIV. Now, just for a second, let's do a little spiritual exercise here. Just close your eyes. And we have a lot of younger people in here, but I mean, there are a lot of us that, me for sure, that HIV was something that we had no idea about, and yet we started having our brothers and sisters fall out left and right with it. So just for a moment, let's just sit with the idea of HIV. And what our beliefs about it are. How maybe we think those people put themselves in that position. If only they'd been better people. Acted nicer. And just how powerless we feel over that. As a real challenge in society. Think of the prayers that you said, the frustration you felt when you had friends that you knew that were going down a path that this might be a consequence for. Now, just for fun, somebody give me a small town, a small manufacturing town in Sweden. That place. Thank you, Joanne. Okay. Now think of that town and what you think about it. Okay? That's what we think about Akron, Ohio. And suddenly, I'm sitting in a bar, maybe a leather bar, and somebody comes in that I know that had HIV. And he tells me that he doesn't have it anymore. Can you imagine what that would be like? And that if I just go to this little town, there are a couple of people, now maybe there's 8 or 10, that have gotten together and they have found a solution for HIV. And I may not like the prescription, but if I go, they've got a way out for me. This is what happened with alcoholism and drug addiction 79 years ago today. An entire fabric was shredded. A consciousness that you were going to die drunk or loaded. And that was the only thing that could possibly happen unless you had enough money that they could lock you away in a nice wing of the house. And that's what the women and men that founded this movement did. Can you imagine how fortunate we are tonight? It took them 3 years to get this many people sober. And today, it is available for people all over the world. So can you imagine why I'm just a little excited to talk today? What a cool deal. What a cool deal. This is a modern medical miracle. About 4 years after AA started, we all have this, fabulous, you got your smartphones, right? Or your dumb phones. I'm going to refer to them a couple times. If you go on xaspeakers.org, everybody, how many people have listened to XA? Okay. If you haven't, it's an amazing resource. And you go on this site, xaspeakers.org, and in the search bar put Bill W. And the talk to look for is called SpireX, S-P-I-R-E-X, for spiritual experience. And Bill's talking about his white light experience to a bunch of recovering priests. Not about his white light, he does a little bit, but he's just talking about the nature of it to this bunch of priests. Am I talking too fast? Okay. If I am, just go like this, okay? Because I get a little excited about this stuff. I really like the fact that I've got bodyguards over here. In case they blast through the door. This is what's called preaching to the choir. But anyway, this talk, SpireX, is fabulous. And in it, Bill's talking about the fact that when AA started, there were a bunch of very, very brilliant psychologists and doctors that were just amazed at what happened. And they did everything they could to encourage the movement. And one of these doctors, Dr. Kennedy, said, okay, we're going to put together a symposium and we're going to get all these guys together to talk about how AA is incredible and how they've all seen these patients that were, you know, as Silkworth talks about in the book, hopeless. Alcoholics were hopeless. And, you know, we'll be able to get a lot of good publicity, and these doctors from being with Dr. Kennedy are going to get all the reflected glory. It's going to be great. It's great for AA. It's great for the medical profession. Let's do it. So Bill goes around and starts talking to these guys again. Not one of them would stand up and come to the symposium. And Bill said, well, what's the deal? And they all, in their own words, said to him, well, you know, we're scientists. And you guys, there's something going on. We've got the abstinence angle, and we've got the moral psychology angle, but there's something else going on. That we've got the altruism, but there's something else going on. We call it the X factor. And we can't support you because we can't quantify the grace of God. Now, we're sitting in a room today with evidence. And yet there's all kinds of folks that say, well, this spiritual stuff, it's just a bunch of heebie-jeebie stuff that these Americans are exporting. It's a subvert Christianity deal. Come on. And anybody that's got any real smarts, they just sit in these meetings and they help others, and it's okay. But, you know, don't give us this spiritual stuff. And but without it, we don't exist. So what's the nature of spiritual experience? What is the nature of it? I think what I'd like to do is let's take a 10-minute break. If we're going to stop at 7, let's take a 10-minute break, and then when we come back, I'll talk about the nature of spiritual experience, and we'll go from there. Okay? Thanks.